Hello, welcome to Interdependent Study, our podcast where we engage in the learning and unlearning work for collective liberation. I'm Damian.
And I'm Aaron. Thank you so much for joining us today. Each week we'll bring something new to the table, discuss our thoughts and feelings about it through the lenses of who we are and where we can go for a more just society.
We want Interdependent Study to be a space where we're always learning with one another. And Aaron is up this week.
Ooh.
What have you brought to the table today, my friend?
I'm surprised.
I'm sure you are.
Yeah. I'm bringing a book called Rehearsals for Living by Robin Maynard and Leanne Betasamasake Simpson. It's a dialogue between two organizers as they write letters to each other throughout the pandemic about liberatory theory and action and how they're coping with the pandemic with their respective families. And they're making brilliant connections between movements throughout the work. There are six parts in the book where they write back and forth to each other. And I highlighted something that Leanne wrote in the first part.
Okay.
Our world-making projects of abolition and decolonization are enmeshed. We are globally positioned as the first to die when the crises hit, and their solutions always preserve the systems that produce these conditions. Our communities are already post-apocalyptic experts and can best imagine worlds beyond our current realities. But in order to imagine, some of us have to first survive.
Ooh.
So I wanted to bring that quote to open up how we're going to talk about the book today, because I think this speaks directly to the way that white supremacy and settler colonialism have worked together to make Black and Indigenous people disposable.
Yes.
Right? She talks about already post-apocalyptic experts and can best imagine worlds beyond our current realities. And so we can see how they are intertwining these struggles, their own struggles, that one another's struggles, and applying it to their own. There's so much in this book.
Yes.
I started to write down some of the things I wanted to talk about here. And as I got started thinking about what I want to talk, and the list of things that I am not going to talk about today is very long.
Absolutely.
So I just kept finding another note that I wanted to talk about and mention. So yeah, there's a lot that we're not going to talk about. And I think reading this book is just something I would really recommend to
Absolutely.
People, because there's a lot of learning that they're doing with each other throughout the book. They're responding to each other and taking analysis from each other and sharpening each other's analysis and continuing to grow. And I just thought it was really, really great and beautiful in a lot of ways.
Yes.
But you know, since we figured out a way to narrow it down so this episode doesn't go on for hours and hours, you know, where do you want to begin?
No. Strap in. We're going for hours and hours.
All right. The first 3-hour podcast.
That's right. This would be an understatement to say, but this was a truly incredible book. I felt like in many ways it's so different from a lot of the other books that we've had a chance to read so far, which makes it stand out to me in such an incredible way. I think what stood out to me overall about this book that I wanted to name and talk about, and you sort of alluded to that, was the way in which they structured this book, right? The fact that they wrote these letters, you talked about that they, you know, sort of sharpened each other's analyses back and forth. I think that work that they did, that vulnerability in which they showed each other, the work that they did through these letters and in writing this book, makes it such a powerful resource to all of us. And so, you know, to me, to get to witness them share their lives, their struggles, their stories, their work, was so beautiful. But I think the ways in which they weaved their stories together in response to one another, the ways that they connected their respective communities' experiences with all of those things you mentioned, oppression, white supremacy, state-sanctioned violence, capitalism, genocide, settler colonialism, like the list goes on and on, right? And they sort of tackle so many things in this book. I think that's what makes this book so profound to me. You know, and we started to talk about this a little bit last week when you intro'd this book, but Their work reminds us of how important it is to recognize the interconnectedness of our existence in this world, right? Yeah. And the need for solidarity was so helpful to me, and a reminder about how to continue to frame this work we do, how to engage in the conversations that we have, how to simply fight for what it is that we believe in. Mm-hmm. And sort of broadly speaking, if you will, right? Like, I think it made their arguments and calls for abolition and for what our future world can and should look like more real, right? Yeah. More vivid, more necessary, right? When you make it personal, which it is, but also do it in such a, with such brilliance and such analysis, right? You bring it all in this way. It all feels so important and necessary. And so I really loved this book and appreciate it so much.
Yeah, they made it vivid. They were rehearsing what it looks like in the world after this one.
Yes, absolutely. In so many ways, there were times where I thought about this idea of back and forth, and you know, it made me think about conversations. It made me think about our podcast, right? Mm-hmm. It made me think about, you know, what it means to live in a world and be connected with each other and to share struggles, to share information, to share experiences. And so, you know, I'm not saying we're doing this in any way, shape, or form at the level that they wrote this book, but it made me appreciate this that we get to do together as well.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a parallel.
Yes.
Even if we're not in the same, ballpark.
Yeah.
All right. So I jumping ahead a little bit to part four of the book. Robin is writing about an op-ed that she read that included the phrase, "Let's save some outrage." Mm-hmm. And that was part of the title.
Yes.
Which she points out is both ridiculous and a reality of the situation.
Right.
So she shares that outrage needs to be carefully portioned out and not wasted at all.
Yes.
And then she goes on to say, quote, "We live in a society that requires that we tolerate a certain significant level of violence and death. People dying of overdoses, of exposure by the hands of police. This is a collateral damage of the mode of governance we live under. Outrage, then, is finite. It necessarily has an endpoint, lest the discomfort leads to a broader demand for the always possible, continually deferred transformations that will be required to shift the tyrannical racial logics of our time. And so outrage needs to be carefully portioned out in moderated doses in order to preserve the status quo." Mm. And so this stuck out to me, one, because I think it connects back to our conversation from last week about civility.
Yes.
And how, you know, we have to save up some outrage, because if we get too outraged, we're not civil in some ways. But it's such a perfect example of how different pieces of our society, and they're in Canada, and that op-ed was in Canada, but there's a lot of connections and similarities.
Oh, absolutely. But
how so many different pieces of this society work to preserve what already exists, including individuals, right? We get trained to preserve what exists, preserve what we know. And it reminds me of how often people want to see gradual change because they're not currently the direct recipients of the oppression.
Right.
That is occurring, and they're worried that they'll suddenly be negatively affected if something does change.
Yes.
So if we defund the police, what's going to happen? What about, what if?
Yes.
And we go down the what ifs, and that's such a big way to preserve what the status quo is currently. Mm-hmm. And it happens the same way with media, as Robin points out. You know, the media is corporately owned and so is invested in maintaining some version of the status quo because it exists effectively within the way that things are.
Yes.
At least for the owners of those corporations. Mm-hmm. So, you know, part of this work toward liberation is finding our own intolerance of violence and death and acting that out and finding the outrage in us and not needing to moderate it out.
Not at all.
In doses, but to act on it and to find, you know, our own place where liberation exists.
Absolutely. To use it, right? Mm-hmm. To absolutely use it. And that's what they're sort of calling for here. And in many ways, as you talked about at the top, right? They wrote these letters in the pandemic, right? As a way to sort of survive the pandemic together from afar, but to talk about what it is that we were experiencing, they were experiencing in the places in which they live, and we were experiencing globally, right? And so I very much so appreciated the attention to outrage in that section too. I felt like I highlighted a lot in that section too. I think kind of related to that, one of the things I wanted to talk about, you know, our 3-hour episode here that I think relates to that is, you know, again, they were writing from this place where we were living through the pandemic, and they were talking about how the pandemic was affecting both of their communities, right? Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that they, I think they wanted to do with this book is amplify Black and Indigenous organizing and resistance to not only the pandemic, but sort of also more broadly as it relates to our world, right? Like, how do we use this outrage that we're feeling and experiencing in ways that matter, right? In ways that actually protect and serve our communities. So Leanne set some context for this in one of her letters to Robin, and so I wanted to share this. Quote, both of our communities faced overcrowded living conditions on reserve and in urban centers, housing and food insecurity, and increased exposure to the virus in prisons and detention centers, and the lack of access to quality health care. We have witnessed increased police targeting and surveillance of Black people, increased exposure from frontline work with a lack of personal protective equipment, and deplorable living and working conditions on farms and in prisons and in detention centers. For both our communities, the structural and systemic nature of anti-Blackness and colonialism and their deliberately planned and enforced poverty position our relations as the most vulnerable to COVID-19, all the while obfuscating this fact.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so all of that is so true. But one of the things I was thinking about this, and I think more broadly applies, is that the pandemic really just highlighted how dangerous this world has been to these communities, right? Mm-hmm. The pandemic, I think, only exacerbated the conditions in which people were living and the forces of oppression that had been constantly working against Black and Indigenous communities, right? Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, those forces, you know, they continued to this day, right? Even as we are sort of quote unquote, you know, beyond the pandemic, right? Like the CDC, you know, said we're done, but we're just done.
Yeah, we're just done.
Yeah. But you know, that to me, that this part of the book and their analysis and conversation about the pandemic and, you know, the ways in which it only showed the ways in which, you know, these conditions have already existed and exacerbated them, I think, is so important, right? Makes this work so important. And when we have to, I think, in Robin's own words, we have to build worlds that affirm lives rather than destroy lives.
Yes, in so many ways. And I think about the ways that our lives, the ways that we destroy land to create something new.
Yeah.
They talk about this in the opening, where they talk about all the death and destruction of people across the world.
Mm-hmm.
And all of it is concentrated in this 2-mile walk in Toronto of of the headquarters of these corporations, which are, described as like soulless gray high rises.
Mm-hmm.
And I forget who writes it. I think it's Leanne.
I think so.
Says, this is what we got out of all of that death is like these. And so that makes me think of it too, is what is the world that we are building and how is that affirming life versus destroying life? And what are we getting out of the destruction of that life?
Yes. And who is suffering because of the result of that destruction of property and life. And yes, absolutely.
And so part 5 is about our connection to land as people. And in many ways, how we've been disconnected from a reciprocal relationship with the land because of capitalism and colonialism. And it's called We Are Peoples of the Lands, of more lands than could ever be counted. One of the parts that sticks out to me from this is something Robin wrote. She said, I find it helpful to remember that Europeans too had their own relationships to lands. They colonized themselves, of course, before they ventured out to the rest of us. And they were not unified. They had created their own subclasses of people on the continent before they left and projected those features onto us. Their expropriation of European peasants from the land, its subsequent devastation, the destruction of the commons is their own ghost, from whose haunting they have not yet emerged. And so this part stuck out to me because it points to a European relationship to land.
Yes.
Before private property was a thing, mm-hmm. before the enclosure of the commons, before whiteness was a thing. And this means it's possible to undo it.
Right. Absolutely.
In so many ways, so much of what we live in currently are creations of men, which means they are things that we can undo, yes. and we can create something new collectively. Yes. And it reminds me of the Ursula K. Le Guin quote. She said, "We live in capitalism. Its power seems inescapable. So did the divine right of kings. Any human power can be resisted and changed by human beings. Resistance and change often begin in art, and very often in art, the art of words." Mm. So we can resist and change what it is we know now.
Absolutely.
To become something else. You know, to go back to what you said, we can build worlds that affirm lives rather than destroy lives, yes. and, you know, undo the things, the ways that we exist with one another now that is not life affirming, but death affirming. Death bringing.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I love what you said there, and I know other folks have talked about this too, but this idea that all of these things are person made, are man made, yeah. are white man made. If people can make these things, people can dismantle them. Mm-hmm. Like that to me is one of the biggest rationales for the work of abolition, right? And the ways in which we can talk about it. We have built prisons. We have built these systems. They exist and they operate because people operate them, right? And control them and decide who is worthy and who is not, right? And so in the same way that all of that is happening, the same can be applied to getting rid of them, right? Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. I love that you talked about land, right? Because there's so much discussion in this book about land, right? And, mm-hmm. and that they wrote letters to each other talking about Black and Indigenous communities' experiences with the land, with the state, right? And I think they were trying to do that and doing that work to think about and dream about a world that better serves their communities, right? And certainly all of us. So one of the things they talk a lot about was this idea of how Black and Indigenous communities have had generative, powerful, beautiful connections with the land and with this planet that we live on, but some not so great ones as well too, right? Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that Leanne said in one of her letters, I think was beautiful, right? I think it can serve as a guide for the kind of work we need to do. And it's a long quote, but I really wanted to share it. She says this, quote, "What if Black and Indigenous relationality refuses settler logics and centers the dismantling in a grounding of the very best practice of Indigenous and Black radical politics? What does it look like if we are all engaged in generating theory, organizing to the specificities of our lived experiences, but we are deeply linked in our distinctive world-building relationalities to ensure the worlds we build do not restrict, enclose, or eliminate Black and Indigenous life? What worlds do Indigenous and Black land politics-based politics give breath to? And how do we connect these to anti-colonial movements outside of North America and beyond? What does it mean to equitably share land, time, space, and the gifts of creation? What does this look like? What does it feel like? Can we make Indigenous and Black futurities against social death relationally responsive to each other? There is no justice in land back if it is not in concert with the destruction of racial capitalism and if Black people remain landless. There is no justice in land back if we are silent with regard to the radical imaginings of Black futures and Black struggles for freedom, just as there is no freedom if Black liberation is framed through the ongoing dispossession of Indigenous peoples."
Yeah.
Right? Like, mm-hmm. to me, part of the many things that stood out to me about that quote is just there's so many guiding questions in there, right? And sort of reminders of how interconnected we are, right? And it's so important, I think, that we keep all of that in mind as we engage in this work. But the interconnectedness of our lived experiences is so valid and real and important and necessary for us to think about as we try to dismantle these things that aren't serving us, that aren't helping us, that are killing us, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's a quote that I wanted to talk about too. Yes. So thanks for bringing it. I had that highlighted and written down in my preparation.
Yeah. It felt too good notes. Not to share. Absolutely.
Yeah. And I love the reciprocal nature of there is no justice in land back if we're silent with regard to radical imaginings of Black futures and Black struggles for freedom. In the same way that there's no justice in Black liberation if it's framed through the ongoing dispossession of Indigenous peoples.
Yes.
And I think that goes beyond the example that because they're talking to one another here.
Correct.
And representing two different communities, two different perspectives, two different experiences. But it applies to all of us. We can't continue to have systems where some of us get ahead at the expense mm-hmm. of others.
Yes.
That can't be the way that we move forward from here. And so I love that quote, and thank you for bringing it.
I mean, the point is simply this. My liberation as a Black man is connected to your liberation as a white man, right?
Yeah.
Absolutely. I want to see the best for you and everyone that you love, me included. And I, you know, and that can't happen at my expense, right?
You're right.
And vice versa, right? Mm-hmm. It's that simple. It's that
yes.
simple.
Exactly. All right. Well, we're starting to apply these things to our life. We have been doing that a little bit throughout.
Yeah.
But to you know, help us not have an hours long episode. Let's go ahead and shift here. We'll talk about some application.
Okay.
How do we apply this book and what we've learned from it to our day-to-day lives? Hey there, folks. Sorry for the interruption, but we wanted to invite you to join us over on Patreon.
Yeah, we're so excited to be on Patreon and be able to create some additional content and opportunities for us to learn and unlearn together.
That's right. We'll be rolling out some new ways you can join us in our collective learning and unlearning over the next few weeks.
So you can join for free and get some regular updates from us. And we'll also have paid tiers available as well with extra content available each month.
You can find us at patreon.com/interdependent study. And join us today.
That's right. You can join right now at patreon.com/interdependent study. Okay, now back to the episode.
patreon.com/interdependent study. My application is another quote from the book because, again, I had a long list of them and I wanted to bring as many as I could.
Yes.
This one's from Leanne from the closing paragraph of part 4. She writes, quote, "I want to build societies where we can take care of the land and the waters and live in a way that promotes more life. I want to live in a way that doesn't cause the extinction of vast numbers of plants and animals, where environmental desecration isn't inevitable, where extractivist economies are not the norm, and where capitalism is not assumed to be permanent, where there are communal and embodied ethics and practices that make slavery and colonialism unthinkable, where 100 musicians show up at a busy intersection and no one is surprised, where we literally change the air and it saves the planet."
Mm.
This is, for me, the application of the book.
Yes.
This is what all of us are working toward. All of us who are working toward collective liberation, this is what we're looking for.
Yes.
We want to move away from extractivist economies. We want more reciprocity between ourselves and our environment. And ourselves in the broadest way possible. Like mm-hmm. all of us on this planet recognizing the, you know, what you said, that our relationship, our liberation is bound up in the liberation of one another. We're not free until all of us are free.
Absolutely. That's such a beautiful quote. I mean, I'm just imagining 100 musicians mm-hmm. showing up at an intersection. How beautiful yeah. would that be?
Yeah. And let me actually explain that real quick, because she's telling a story earlier in that
yes.
letter where it's somebody mishears the news in the story and thinks that 100 musicians are showing up mm-hmm. and it's really 100 National Guards people or something like that.
Yeah.
And And it the point is, wouldn't it be beautiful if like the government chose to send 100 musicians to an intersection,
yes,
to perform? Like, what does that world look like? And what's the meaning behind that in that world? Like, why is that a thing that exists in that world that we're imagining there?
Absolutely.
So yeah,
good context. Yeah. I knew that because I read the book. But thank you for sharing. Yeah, I love that story, and I love the connection and the use of it in her work to dream about this. Right.
Yeah.
Talking about, I want this. I want to live in a world that does this versus the world that we have. That's great application. Mm-hmm. I'm going to try to bring equally good application here, because I went back and forth. Like, there's so much in this. There's so much wisdom in this book.
Yes.
And insight to bring here. So I decided to not use words from either Leanne or Robin. The afterword is written by our friend, Dr. Robin D.G. Kelly. And he was talking about sort of what Robin and Leanne were able to do and communicate so brilliantly in this book. And so I found something that stuck out to me as something that could both praise them for this great work that they did in this book, but also serve as application. So Dr. Kelly said this, quote, "The struggle to hold the land, to block machines of annihilation, to grow food and feed one another, this is life in rehearsal. Robin Maynard and Leanne Bettis-Amasake Simpson are able to see past the catastrophe in order to make plans, but they are no mere dreamers. They understand that the work of building the new world is no luxury, and that our very survival depends on turning dreams of decolonization and abolition into action." Mm-hmm. And I think it's that last piece for me, right? Our very survival depends on turning these dreams, this fight, this work for abolition into reality, right? And and with everything that Robin and Leanne talk about in this book, with everything going on in the world right now, I think the application here is that we have no other choice.
Yeah, I love that word annihilation that he used there, to block the machines of annihilation, the systems of annihilation that feed the machine. I think that we have no choice. We have to find something else, because we're burning the very home that we have, the only home that we have constantly, and we have been for a long time. And you know, a lot of people are just doubling down on that.
Mm, so unfortunately so.
And, you know, not just environmentally, but we're, you know, in so many ways we're annihilating each other. And
yes.
That
word is powerful. And that word was absolutely, I have not talked to Dr. Kelly lately, but I know that word was an intentional choice.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
100%.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's talk about homework.
Okay.
What do we want to do to continue our learning beyond our conversation today? So Robin and Leanne have written other books.
Yes.
The one that really speaks to me from their two bibliographies, I suppose, is Leanne's As We Have Always Done, which is about building indigenous resistance movements that refuse the destructive thinking of settler colonialism. So that sounds great.
Yes.
I think it's from 2017.
Okay.
So it's a few years old, but I'm looking forward to finding that and digging into that one.
Yep.
And since Ruth Wilson Gilmore has not yet been mentioned today, and she wrote the foreword, it reminds me that I still want to read her book, Abolition Geography, that came out a couple of years ago. So, you know, two more books for the list. Although I believe Abolition Geography is already on the list.
I think it is.
So I'm only adding one book to the list today.
Great.
Which I think is, you know, I'm going to pat myself on the back for that.
Well done. Yeah. And also gold star for bringing Ruth Wilson Gilmore up. And she did write the foreword, the introduction to this book, and it was brilliant. Mm-hmm. We could, again, in our next iteration of this conversation, we'll talk about her introduction.
Yeah.
Well, pat yourself on the back and then start patting me on the back, because I'm also proposing that we read another book. That's Aaron patting me on the back. So when I was on Haymarket's website to check out this book, I saw that it was part of their Abolitionist Papers series.
Yes, indeed.
And we've now read three of the four books on it. Mm-hmm. So obviously Rehearsals for Living. We read Abolition Feminism Now, and we also read We Do This Till We Free Us. So three incredible books,
yep.
like incredible books that we learned so much from. So the other book in the series is called Resisting Borders and Technologies of Violence. Mm-hmm. It was edited by, and I'm probably going to butcher this name, so I apologize, Mizu Aziki, Matt Mahmoudi, and Colleen Schupfer. And if I got those names wrong, I apologize. But from my brief looking into it, it seems to be a collection of essays and case studies that explore how the high-tech system of surveillance and borders developed and how we can resist that, right? And how we can try to, and we need to live in a world without borders, right? So I figured if we've read three of the four books in this series and Haymarket put these books together for a reason, we got to read this one too.
Well, and that series, I believe, is ongoing. So they're continuing to add more books to it.
Beautiful.
Yeah. Because I think that one's relatively recent,
yes,
right?
Yes, yes.
I've been—
that makes sense.
I've been eyeballing that one because I've seen some publicity and events,
yes.
webinars from Haymarket for that one. So, you know, let's add this to the list.
Yes.
You know, this book, as all books do, just begets more books on the list.
Absolutely. Yeah. I love it.
All right. Well, that's it for our conversation today about Rehearsals for a Living.
What a great conversation.
Well under an hour.
Good for us.
Yeah. It's a lot of editing discipline that we just did there.
Seriously.
And Damien, you're up next time. So what are you bringing to the table in our next episode?
Well, let's keep the excitement going. Because, you know, I know we're both so excited that our friends at Hammer and Hope have released their third edition just earlier this month. And the entire issue is actually focused on the war and the genocide taking place in Palestine. And every essay piece in it provides some historical, political, and humanitarian context for it. Mm. So when it got published, I think we were both messaging each other about it. Like, look, it's out. It's happening. It's here. It was incredibly difficult to figure out, well, which piece do I bring? I'm excited to be the person that actually gets to bring it. Mm-hmm. And I struggled to choose, but I'm going to get us started with a piece called The Courage to Disagree, which was written by Derica Purnell, who we've talked about here before on the podcast. She's a human rights lawyer and activist and author of the book Becoming Abolitionist, Police, Protests, and the Pursuit of Freedom. Mm-hmm. And I'm excited to read this piece in particular because she addresses this age-old issue of folks using Dr. King's words for whatever their social or political agenda might be. right? We see that especially every MLK day. But in this case, it's in the context of what's going on in Palestine right now. And she has, I think, some brilliant analysis about that. Mm-hmm. So I'm so looking forward to reading this piece. It'll be the first of many because we're going to read this whole damn thing.
Yeah.
And I'm excited to talk about it with you next time.
Yeah, me too. I am very excited about the whole issue. I'm excited to dig into this article by Derica Purnell. Her book is great.
Yes.
Too. And so, yeah, well, you know, stay tuned.
Yes.
Join us here next week.
Please do.
But with that, I want to thank you for joining us today. You know what I'm going to ask you to do here, but in case you forgot, please follow, leave a rating and review, share a podcast with the people in your life. Follow us on social media, including Instagram and TikTok. Check us out on YouTube and sign up on our Patreon page to get notified about any new things we've got going on behind the scenes. There's a free tier, so you can join for free. If you also want to send us money for a coffee once a month, like, we'll also take that.
We absolutely will. Thank you so much for listening. And remember, it's not about us, but it is about all of us. And we'll talk to you next week.